Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. I'm so happy to be back with you. I missed last week. I was dealing with a family transition, and that transition has passed. I actually had a very interesting few weeks guiding my cousin, who was living in my home, through hospice as she passed from this world to another. And it was a really beautiful experience. I got to provide a space in my home of a sanctuary where everybody who wanted to say goodbye to her could come and say their words in a really beautiful environment. And so it was lovely, and I'm really glad that that chapter is finished, and I am now back here with you. And so I have a great show planned for you today. My guest is going to be Pam Koch. She is the executive director and research associate professor at the Tisch Food Center. And I love what she's doing. I'm really excited to have her on and share with all of you what she is up to. And she'll be on in a little while after I talk to you about some things going on in and around the news and around our area and, of course, share a recipe with you. So let's start with what's going on. This weekend, there's the Long Island Regional Seed Consortium Seed Swap, which is happening out at Suffolk Community College in Riverhead. And it's always a wonderful opportunity to get seeds from local farmers who are growing specialty crops. And, you know, as a slow food advocate, one of my passions is to help spread diversity in our food system. And this is a way of doing it, to find local farmers who are growing unusual different crops and get those seeds. So if you're around and you're available, come out to the regional food swap this weekend from 1 to 4. On February 18th, I want to encourage all of you to come down to the steps of City Hall. There's going to be a rally that is being sponsored by Sierra Club, Food and Water Watch, and many other progressive groups to tell the mayor that it's time to get offshore wind off the ground in New York City. There's a project being proposed. Oh, I have some beeping here. There is a project being planned off the shores of Long Island Sound, and it would be really great if you guys could come out and help make that happen. Let me see what else. March 3rd is the 7th annual Good Spirits event going on at La Venue in Manhattan. That's being promoted by Edible Manhattan, and it's an opportunity from 6 to 9 p.m. to try some local spirits, many of which are made locally as well. So you can find out more on the Edible Manhattan website. March 5th and 6th, this is a great event taking place in Bryant Park. It's the Kids Food Fest. And this is being sponsored by the James Beard Foundation, and it's a weekend of food and education, an opportunity to come out and learn the importance of achieving balance in food choices, lots of fun activities, sampling for the whole family. It's free. There are tickets being sold to some of the events. I think there's some cooking classes and things like that, but there's a lot to be done. It's free. It's in Bryant Park. Come on out to that. March 8th is a fundraiser for the River Fund, New York. River Fund is the organization that I partner with when I feed the homeless on Thanksgiving and Christmas and Easter. And they're having a big fundraiser. It's called the Empty Bowls event, and it's taking place at Austin's Ale House. And it's a great thing. There's three different seatings, 3 to 4:30, 5 to 6:30 and 7 to 8:30, and you're given a handmade ceramic bowl, and then there's choices of soup and bread, and you get a bowl of soup and bread, and the $15 entry fee goes to support the River Fund's work. And you can come with some friends. It's only $15, so it's a great evening out, and it reminds us that many bowls go empty every day of the week. So that's a wonderful events, so come out to that if you can. The Just Food Conference is around the corner, March 13th. That's always an unbelievable opportunity to sit in on lots of great talks and participate in different hands-on events. It's at Teachers College, Columbia University, March 13th, all day from 9 to 7. $65, $40 for students, well worth it. April 8th and 9th is the Food and Enterprise Summit taking place. April 10th to 12th is the Chef Collaborative Summit. That's in also taking place this year in New York City. So there's so many great events going on. I don't want to take any more time, but check out my website. I list all of these events and links to the actual event site so you can purchase the tickets there. This week, you know, God, I can't believe we have a whole another year to go of this of this election stuff. But anyway, it's really quite amazing what is going on there. Clearly, the American public is not happy with politics as usual and wants something different. Trump is completely scary, but so is everybody else on that side of the ballot. Bernie Sanders is rocking it. That's pretty exciting. But I would really love to see some questions posed to the political candidates that have to do with food policy, because food policy is really, one of the reasons I love food so much. It connects everything. It connects our environmental issues. It connects our economic issues. It connects our health. It connects everything that's important. Food brings people together. Food is what it's about. And so the Food Summit, Food Tank, actually put out 10 questions that they think we should be asking our politicians. And, wouldn't it be great if we just had a debate just on food policy? It would just be so great. But anyway, they have a list of 10 questions that are really great, like asking our politicians whether or not they think we should have a U.S. national food policy. And if so, how would they go about implementing one? Another one would be about GMOs. Are they in favor? I mean, 93% of American population is in favor of GMO labeling. What about them? Let's talk about that. Let's, really get them to talk about it. My guest will be coming on. She's really asking those questions, and she's wrote a great article in the New York Times, an op-ed about, I'm going to let her tell us about it, but about, the op-ed piece was about, oh, Pam, are you there?
I'm here. Hi.
Tell me about your op-ed piece. I'm having a moment.
Oh, sure. First of all, thank you for having me. And I just want to say I completely agree with you that we should have all our politicians talking about food policy, because it really does.
Wouldn't that be great?
It would be wonderful. I would get everybody I know to tune into that debate if we could ever make that happen.
Uh-huh.
So to tell you a little bit about the op-ed piece, first, I wrote it with a great partner of mine, Hans Saparia, from New York University, who's at the business school. And so really what we found is that when we worked together, him having a business perspective and me having a nutrition education consumer perspective, that we can really take a unique look at things, and we hope to continue to work together. What the article was about is that really eating habits are changing, and that's happening across the board. Sometimes people think, it's really happening only with the middle class. I think that it's happening across the board, and really people in low-income neighborhoods want changes too. Sometimes they don't have access to the food, but everybody is interested in eating better, eating where they can eat for their own health, eating so that they can eat more sustainably and truthfully making choices that are more socially just as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we really looked into is that food companies are actually starting to make changes in this direction. And Hans and I think that the food companies are scared because they're realizing they're going to start to lose market share because people want more real whole food and less food with ingredients that they can't pronounce and they don't know what are doing to them or their kids or their families. And so we really think that we're at the as it said in the article, a seismic shift in how people eat, and that really the large food companies are going to start to have to make really transformative changes if they're going to keep Americans as consumers.
I think you're so right. And now I want to backtrack because I apologize. That was no way to bring you right in. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I just, you know, sometimes as we get older, we have those moments, and I am real, and I had one. So anyway, welcome, Pam. I want to introduce my guest today, Pam Koch, who is the Executive Director and Research Associate Professor of Nutrition Education at the Tisch Food Center. And she conducts research about the connections between just and sustainable food system and healthy eating. And she was the primary author in a curriculum series books called Linking Food and the Environment. And I am just so thrilled to have you on. Right now you're at, you are collaborating with many different groups, many of which that I'm very familiar with, the Edible Schoolyard, Wellness in the Schools, and Food Corps. And I'm just thrilled to have you on, Pam, so thank you for joining us.
You're welcome, and I'm excited to be here.
Great. So anyway, I would love you to start, now that you've already started, to backtrack a little and just tell us a little bit about the Tisch Food Center, its history, its mission, and what you're doing there.
Sure. So we're at Teachers College Columbia University, and actually where you just talked about the Just Food Conference, where the Just Food Conference will be in a couple of weeks. So we hope everybody out there listening that can attend will be here. And the program in nutrition at Teachers College is actually the oldest nutrition program in the country. It was started in 1908 by a woman named Mary Schwartz Rose, who was an absolute visionary. She was actually doing nutrition science research before vitamins were even discovered. At the same time, she was really practical. So, for example, she wrote a book during World War I about how to eat during wartime to basically make sure that we were having enough food to send to the troops. And she did all kinds of things about educating children about nutrition and really actually was on the forefront of the field of nutrition and nutrition education across the country. And then our program also started a public health nutrition program in the 1940s. Before that was actually the first public health nutrition program in the country as well. And jumping ahead a little bit more, in 1970, Joan Gussow, who is an emeritus professor here, started teaching a course called Nutritional Ecology that was really centered on the idea that people are getting disconnected from where their food comes from. And if we don't keep people educated about where their food comes from, we're going to end up with a food supply that it is basically what we ended up having, that's overly processed, overly transported, overly packaged, because people aren't aware of that. And actually, she's amazing, 87, still teaching this course today. Which
Joan was on my show
even
a few years ago.
Oh, great. Well, I've been teaching with her for the last few years, and it's been an amazing experience for me, and her course is just as relevant today as it was back when she started teaching it. Additionally, we have a Professor Isabel Contento, who is actually at the forefront of nutrition education in the field, in the country and in the world, and has written the only textbook on nutrition education. So at the Laurie M. Tisch Center for Food Education and Policy, what really we are doing is taking the vision of all three of them, among many other people who have been at the program, and really saying, how can we connect creating a just, sustainable food system with getting people to eat healthier? And as you said, most of our work is in schools with children, most of our on the ground work, and we also work helping to push and promote policies that increase nutrition education and access to good food for everyone.
Yeah, it's a great program. I have known of it for a long time. You've had so many workshops over the years up on your campus, and I've been to many of them, so it's really inspired me a lot in my work. Could you tell us more about the role you believe nutrition education can play in helping to empower and inspire young people?
Yeah, I think when nutrition education is done well, what it really does at its core is it gets young people and everyone excited about wanting to make healthy food choices for themselves. And really what's the, what what good nutrition education does is gets people personally motivated. So it's not about a kind of finger-wagging thing of like, you should be eating this and not eating that. It's about getting people connected to food. And I found that one of the best ways to do that is really, really just great experiences with food. So whenever we have experiences, and the organizations we work with obviously do this as well, where children get experiences growing food and cooking food, that mm-hmm. actually really just gets them excited about food. My doctoral dissertation, which was 20 years ago, but was working with a program called Cook Shop that was started by Tony LaCorey, uh-huh. who's now with School of Food Focus. And really what we showed is that through research that it was when new vegetable and whole grain recipes were introduced into school lunch, the only kids that were actually eating those new recipes were the kids that had nutrition education where they got to cook them in the classroom. And mm-hmm. then they were excited enough that they actually ate them in school lunch.
Right. I know I've seen that personally in my own work. You know, you get kids to grow it, they're much more willing to taste it. And they get, like you said, much more excited about it. And, you know, to the opposite of that is when we're showing kids such bad food in school and we're teaching them in a classroom about school nutrition and there's no correlation between what they're learning in the classroom and what we're role modeling for them. And I think that's the struggle we have so often, is that there's that contradiction taking place.
I completely agree with you. When actually that's such a mixed message, where we're trying to tell them one thing and then what they're experiencing in school and out of school is something really different, it's really hard. It's hard for adults to wrap their heads around that kind of contradiction, and it's even harder for kids. And so, you know, that's one of the things that we really work for, is basically creating environments in schools and in communities where the healthy, sustainable, socially just food choice is the easy and desirable one, and that's put together with really great nutrition education that gets people excited about making those choices.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the strategies that you use to make nutrition education feel relevant? You know, can you share with us some of the projects that you've done?
Sure. Let me give you some really kind of concrete examples. When we were just starting the cookshop program that I talked to you about a little bit ago, mm-hmm. is we were testing out kind of doing some cooking with kids in the classroom. And this was back in the mid-1990s when school lunch was not the hot topic that it is today. Mm-hmm. And we were promoting the kids eating salad in schools. And I was working with a first grade class in Harlem, and it was May in New York City. So as all of you who live in New York know, that's just when the farmers market are starting to have the new stuff from spring coming in. And so I went to the farmers market and bought what was there, and among that was radishes. And so I went into the classroom and I held up all the foods and asked the kids what they were. They actually knew what everything was until I held up the radish. And I had the whole radish with the leaves and all, and I said, what is this? They guessed everything that is red or orange. They said, oh, is it a strawberry? Is it a tomato? Is it a tiny apple? And nobody knew what it was. And when I finally said, this is called a radish, I said, has anybody ever heard of that? And they all said, no. So mm-hmm. I gave each of them, each of these first graders, a fourth of a radish and a plastic knife on a paper plate. And I said, can you cut these radishes really tiny? Because they're going to accent our salad. Radishes taste strong. And I thought, oh, my gosh, I knew the first time I tasted a radish, I didn't really like it because it was
right,
so strong.
Right.
We put them in the salad with all the other stuff we had, and all the kids went down the line. They took the salad, and those kids, as they ate it, said, I love radishes. They're accenting the flavor of our salad. They're making our salad taste great. And I think it was because they had to work so hard with those little plastic knives to cut those radishes into little teeny tiny pieces that connected them to them, and it made them like them when they ate them.
Right, right.
So that's
true.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
That's just an example of a strategy where when you get people really connected to food in ways that will make it personally motivating, that's what's actually going to make them make changes. And then the second big strategy is really to give people the appropriate knowledge and skills they need to make the healthy choices. Sometimes they don't need to know everything about nutrition science or everything about food, but they need to know the practical things that are really going to make a difference to make them be able to make the healthy, good food choices in their lives.
Mm-hmm. Recently, I was told that the Tisch Food Center has developed a middle school curriculum, and that's new, that you kind of did it in collaboration or to go along with the documentary In Defense of Food, which is Michael Pollan's, a documentary made on the Michael Pollan's book. Can you tell us more about that curriculum and how that came to be?
Sure. Let me start with how it came to be. First, the company Kick'em Media is the one who made the documentary film In Defense of Food about Michael Pollan's book. And to get the, obviously it costs a lot of money to make a film. So to get the funding for that, they wrote a grant to the National Science Foundation. And the National Science Foundation, for all of their projects, always wants really good outreach materials to go with them. And so we were part of the project from basically the very beginning and helped them with writing this curriculum into the grant, and so it was part of the grant from the National Science Foundation. And what we did is worked really closely with the filmmakers through the whole process of them making the film to get scenes from the film or clips from the film that would actually really resonate with middle school students. And so we used those clips as the foundation for the lessons and then created really great engaging activities for the students to get them to do exactly the things that I was just talking about. Get them personally excited so they want to make healthy food choices for themselves, and then really give them practical skills so they can. One of the things that we do in the curriculum, if anybody has read Michael Pollan's books, he calls highly processed foods edible food-like substances. And we thought we could come up with something for middle school students that would make sense. And so we call foods real whole foods, and then all the highly processed foods in the curriculum are called FUDs. P-H-U-D-S. And so it was great to have that other word that we could say, instead of eating FUDs, eat foods. And really, the curriculum, probably, if I could sum it up, is basically about having them realize how much they're tricked by marketing and tricked by the food supply we have. And adolescents don't want to be tricked. They want to make their own independent choices. So we're kind of taking on their sense of wanting to be independent, their sense of wanting to make their own choices, and saying, make the choices that are going to be good for your body, good for the earth, so that you can actually be the best person you could possibly be.
Right. Yeah. When, that works a lot when you, try to, or you share with young people that they're being manipulated every day, that they are being subjected to the advertising, that's a whole nother piece of, how much marketing happens to them and how they're being pushed to desire these foods that are not good for them and, as you said, also not good for the earth. And, as young people, they are so passionate about the planet. They hold that true. They really recognize the problems, and I think most of them see the problems on a regular basis and want to do something about it. And so when you can engage that desire of theirs to do the right thing and to outsmart the people that are trying to trick them, as you said, they get involved. They get involved. Now, what do you think about the free lunch program, the idea of offering free lunch to all students? What's your feeling on that?
Now, universal free lunch, I think, is just a fabulous idea. We have made it so that lunch is this part of the school day where, the kids that families can't afford it get it for free, but then everybody else pays for it, whereas everything else during the school day isn't like that. We don't say, some parents have to pay for the books, but other parents don't. Kids just get the books. They get what they need for school. And I think that if we make lunch universally free, it can help us really make lunch a much more integrated part of the school day, just what all kids need to do in the middle of the school day. They're at school enough hours that they're going to need to eat in the middle of the school day, and it brings everybody together. It takes away the stigma that it's just for kids whose parents can't afford it, and it makes it something for everyone. It would also, I believe, open up opportunities that we can make lunchtime an educational time, so a time to have really good exposure to good foods and educate kids and get them excited about eating well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also had Jam Pompadick on my radio show, and I was up at Hunter College, at City Center or City College last week or the week before for their breakfast panel. And it's, you know, just a great, you know, it would be great to see that program expanded, not just even all of New York City, but across the country, because, as you said, the stigma involved with those kids that get it free versus those that don't very often makes kids not even want to participate in the free lunch that they're entitled to because of that. And also, as you said, it could then, we could set the lunch program up as a example of healthy eating and kind of coordinate the education they're getting in the classroom with what they can do in the kitchen.
I just want to add on here that, at the breakfast, in, food policy for breakfast, one of our students, Renata Peralta, was one of the presenters, and she actually did surveys with the middle school principals who, after 1 year of having universal free lunch, and there was a lot of great findings from that. But one I want to point out, and I've worked with New York City Public Schools for over 20 years, 65 of 65 principals said that they thought that this was a really great policy that the DOE enacted to have universal free lunch for middle, standalone middle schools, and 65 of 65 thought that it should be expanded to elementary and high school. I can tell you in 20 years of working with New York City Public Schools about things that have to do with academia or anything else, I don't think you could get all 65 principals to agree on anything that the DOE has done is really a good thing. And this just shows how important this is and how it actually makes the lunch part of the day easier for schools, because then it's just for everybody.
Right. You know, even just the logistics of collecting money slows that line up, and you know how little time they have to eat as it is. And I heard this when my kids were in public school, you know, just waiting online would take them practically half the lunch period, and the lunch period is already only half a period, and so they would left with 5 minutes, if that, to eat, and yeah, it's just, it's terrible. So it just, you know, makes sense on so many levels. I would really love to see that expanded. So anybody out there, if you ever come across an opportunity to put that out there, you know, in your local school, or any opportunity to sign a petition for policy change, please add your signature. So going back to the curriculum, is there anything particular about the middle school curriculum that you want to share with us that you designed?
Well, I think that to add on to what I said before is, because it's middle school students who are really interested in their peer connections, we have developed into the curriculum experiences for them to teach each other, share with each other, learn from each other. So it's very, very student-oriented. The other thing is there's lots of things, like you were saying before, that really help them see how much they are tricked by advertisements. One of the activities, which everybody that's seen it, I think, just gets blown away by it, is we take logos of the food companies and show them just a teeny part of it, and in a second, everybody knows almost all of those logos, which just shows how pervasive they are in our society. And when the students see that, they're like, oh my gosh, yeah, now I see, like, this is just all in my brain because I've seen so many of these advertisements. And it starts to kind of break down what the food companies are really doing and how much they are influencing how they're making choices. And I think it makes them want to eat healthier. Combined with that, they have lots and lots of opportunities to cook and eat fresh, real, whole foods. And I think then getting those really great experiences, cooking and eating those healthy foods from whole plants, I think just then gets them super excited about eating foods and not eating fuds.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you have many of the schools that you're working with actually growing gardens? Have they started school gardens either on rooftops or, you know, dug up some of the pavement and put in gardens? What are you seeing?
Yeah, so, well, one of our doctoral students who actually just graduated in May, Kate Gardner-Burt, did a look at school gardens, really successful school gardens in New York City. And the school garden movement in New York City is completely on the rise. It was Grow to Learn registers the school gardens in New York City and actually is kind of the hub for all the resources for school gardens. When we started this project in 2013, there was just over 300 registered school gardens. I don't know what it is now, but the last time I checked, it was well over 500 just a couple of years later. And so it just shows how much this is on the increase. what we have found is that there are schools doing school gardens in every way in New York City, and I think around the country too, every way imaginable. Sometimes it's just basically pots that you can hang on a fence outside of the school because there really is no space for a garden, and they can grow pretty significant stuff that way, up to like amazing hydroponic greenhouses on the roofs or hydroponic classrooms and gardens that have multiple outside beds for, you know, basically a few classes to be able to be in at a time. And so it's really taking off, and what I think is even more exciting about it is more and more schools are finding ways to actually really integrate the garden experience into the curriculum experience and connect what they're doing into the garden into science, which is an obvious connection, into social studies to learn about how different cultures grow food and eat food, into English by having students go to the garden and write about their experiences in the garden, and even math as they're planning, you know, how to plant things in the garden. So they're really connecting it, and they're also connecting the garden to the school community and the whole overall philosophy of the school to make it really all about kind of healthy eating and caring about food is central to the kind of whole mission of the school.
Well, I don't know if you know, I run my local slow food chapter. I'm also, or I was a Waldorf teacher, you know, and I ran the school cafeteria at the Waldorf school out here. So, you know, through that, I also was doing curriculum, you know, many years ago, and have found that the schools out here, for whatever reason, they are more resistant. I think they, you know, everyone's afraid of giving up that time in the classroom. It makes me crazy because the slow food movement is really trying to promote school gardens and expand it. And I know out on the East End where they have so many farms, they've been more successful. I'm kind of in the middle of Long Island, and I found a lot of resistance, you know, and it's not just me personally. I'm talking with parents that have come to me to help them try to get gardens off the ground. They're meeting with the PTAs, and everybody's about, you know, the classroom testing, and it's a very different, mentality, and people just are afraid to give up that time and to get started. And I think also you need someone from the inside that's really passionate about it to make it happen. But it's hard. It's hard. You know, we have a few gardens, but it's hard to get them going here.
Yeah. No, it's hard. Actually, just to give you a great example, which was one of the schools in Kate's study, happens to be the school where my son goes to middle school, which is Columbia Secondary School. That's a public school, but in partnership with Columbia. And the sixth grade English teacher, Meredith Hill, is also the garden coordinator. So she teaches sixth grade English through food. And basically they read the Young Reader's edition of Omnivore's Dilemma along with lots of other critical pieces about food and the food system, and then get experiences in the garden. And that's just a great way where she's meeting all the standards for sixth grade English and doing it through the lens of food and the food system and basically learning to think critically about your food choices.
Yeah, well, like I said at the beginning, one of the reasons I'm so passionate about it is because it really, food, unlike anything else, I think really can touch on all those different pieces that you just mentioned. You know, it's just, it's amazing. You can just, and it brings people together. It's the social interaction that happens around food that is different than most of the other learning experiences kids have in the classroom, which is so individual. This is really more collaborative. And I think, you know, the more opportunities we have to help kids work collaboratively, that's also a benefit for them.
I totally agree. And a lot of the principals that we've talked to about this say, we're really trying to educate the whole child. And if we just focus on academics, and yet we're having kids that are going to have these high risks of getting diseases like type 2 diabetes, we haven't done our full job. We need to look at the whole child and look at their health, look at their experiences, think about how they look at the world, think about how they're going to work together. And food, you're right, is just a perfect way to get students involved in that.
Yeah. We're going to take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, I actually picked out a recipe today that I wanted to share because it was such a kid-friendly recipe, a multigrain pancake recipe. So when we come back, I'm going to share that recipe, and then we'll continue talking about some policy issues, some, you know, where you could see this could go to really make the change we want to see happen in the schools happen. So everyone listening, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Pam Koch from the Tisch Food Center, and we'll be right back.
This is PRN.FM. Tune in anytime for the latest in progressive news and ideas. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Hi, I'm Dr. Cheryl Selman, the host of What Women Must Know. As a naturopathic doctor, psychotherapist, author, and women's health advocate, I've discovered that there is a lot that women must know when it comes to their health and hormones. So whatever your hormonal or health challenge may be, the answers are waiting for you at What Women Must Know. Where leading authors and holistic practitioners, researchers, and wise elders will give you the keys to getting your hormones back on track naturally. Be sure to listen every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM. And if you didn't catch it live, you can listen 24/7 on the archive. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Hi there, this is Harvey Wasserman. I am the host of the Solartopia Green Power Wellness Show, which airs every Monday at 3 p.m. at PRN.FM. We cover the great issues of your health and wellness, of the health and wellness of the planet, of moving ahead towards a Solartopian, green-powered, holistic Earth. Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Hi, I'm Sandy Leon Best, host of Political Analysis. Welcome to the 21st century, where the corporate propaganda machine works 24/7 to manufacture your reality. Every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, Political Analysis challenges the corporate narrative with independent news, analysis, and passionate conversations on the most critical issues of our time. Don't let the corporate echo machine become your truth. Tune in live to Political Analysis or visit the archives at PRN.FM. If you like the show, rate us in iTunes. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
Stay tuned to PRN.FM for more empowering ideas from progressive voices. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm here with my guest, Pam Koch, from the Tisch Food Center, and I am going to share with you, before she comes back on, a recipe for multigrain pancakes. These are really kid-friendly. You can add different varieties of fruit to them to individualize them for whatever flavor each individual child wants. And it's also a great way that they can get involved in decorating their own pancakes. But anyway, the ingredients you need is, this makes 12 to 14 pancakes, a half a cup of unbleached white flour, one quarter cup of whole wheat flour, a half a cup of oats that I ground in the food processor to become a flour, and I measured it, the half a cup after I ground it, a quarter cup of cornmeal, a half a cup of finely chopped walnuts, 2 teaspoons baking powder, 1 teaspoon baking soda, 2 tablespoons sugar, a half a teaspoon salt, 2 organic eggs, 1 1/4 cup buttermilk. Now, I don't usually have buttermilk in my house, so I took a cup and a quarter of regular milk, and I added 1 tablespoon of apple cider vinegar to it and let it sit for 10 minutes, and that turns it into the equivalent of buttermilk, so you can do that. 3 tablespoons melted butter, 1 teaspoon vanilla, and then bananas or other berries that you might want to add to it. And you are going to mix the dry ingredients together in a bowl, and then in a separate bowl you can mix the wet ingredients together. And then you're going to add the dry ingredients to the wet ingredients and just mix it up and combine it, but don't overmix it. You don't want to beat it up. You're not going to use an electric mixer for this. Just use a spoon is fine. Spray the griddle with some oil. I use a heavy cast iron griddle. It works great. If you don't have that, you can use any frying pan. Pour out the round pancakes, or if you're doing it with kids, you can even have them pour it out into shapes. Valentine's Day is coming up, so heart-shaped pancakes are lots of fun. And you're going to cook it on one side until you start seeing the edges start drying out and little bubbles throughout the pancakes, and that's when you know they're ready to flip over. Before I flip them is when I put in the fruit so that, you know, I can individualize them. And like I said, the kids can put the bananas on or the berries on. Then you flip it over, and you're just going to cook it on the other side for 1 to 2 minutes and serve it with some fresh, real maple syrup and butter. And they're delicious. You know, if you want to leave the sugar out, you can. And they're really great. So enjoy them. Enjoy them. Make them for Valentine's Day. They're fun. And so now I'd like to invite Pam back on. Are you with me, Pam?
I'm here, and that recipe sounds delicious.
Great. Yeah, they are good. They're really good. I had, as I was saying, my cousin passed away here, but I had her daughters here for a couple of weeks, and so I was making breakfast that I don't usually make, and they really enjoyed the pancakes, so that was fun, so I thought I'd share it with everyone. So I wanted to talk about some policy shifts. You know, what sort of policy shifts would you like to see, you know, on a global scale that would help change our food system to help improve the school food and everybody's food in general?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that, you know, since our foundation is really doing nutrition education, first of all, we always support all of the programs that are trying to provide access to people who don't have the resources to have food to get food. And what we think can actually really help the resources that are going into providing access to food is if we could put more funding towards doing nutrition education along with these programs. So starting with schools is through the school meals program, as I said before, really making that it's not just about serving kids food, but really combined with that is education that will get kids, as I talked about what we did before, is getting them to cook some of the recipes that are going to be served in school food in the classroom to try them out and get them excited about them, getting them to really understand that, you know, schools have salad bars to get them to enjoy eating more fresh, whole vegetables. Outside of that is also everything that is for communities. We have our Women's Infants and Children program in this country that supports pregnant women and children that will now actually it'll be changed to children up to 6 years old to get access to good, healthy foods. And that does have nutrition education in with it. And to basically, we would say, make sure increase that and make sure they're getting really good nutrition education so they're excited about eating the healthy foods that they're getting. And we have SNAP is Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which was formerly food stamps, and there's a large program called SNAP Education, and truthfully, that can sometimes be something where funding gets cut, and there has been excellent work across the country through every state doing SNAP Education, basically getting SNAP-eligible audiences through communities, through schools, basically really excited about making healthy food choices. And when we can combine together giving people adequate resources to get good foods and get them excited about eating them, and give them the skills to do that, we think that that's going to basically make all of the policies and the funding that's going into these programs go a lot further to really help keep people healthy and help us actually move towards having a food supply where healthy choices are what is, you know, right front and center for people to be able to get and eat.
One question I have for you, because I really, you know, it's something that really troubles me. I know with SNAP, people can, you know, get a certain amount of money and they can make their food choices. So if they want to choose to spend more to buy organic milk or organic eggs, they can do that. But the WIC program drives me crazy because they don't have that flexibility. There's only certain milk, certain eggs that they can get, and those are, that's unorganic milk, at least the last I checked, and unorganic eggs. You know, what can we do to change that? Because, you know, here we're giving them the opportunity to supplement their income by offering foods, but we're teaching them that, you know, hormones and antibiotics in their food system is bad for them, and yet we are only offering them those products. What can we do about that?
Well, I think that that's where, and I talked about the nutrition education piece of policy, I think that's where also what we have to be doing is working on our farm policy, and every 5 years we have a farm bill, and basically we have to be changing and shifting that policy to make it easier for producers and give basically the producers that are producing organic foods and producing foods that are actually cleaner foods that have less hormones and antibiotics and all of that in it, make that easier for those producers to do that so that can actually become a larger part of the food supply. Unfortunately, even though there's a lot of demand for that, and that kind of goes back to my New York Times piece, the supply isn't quite there yet, and because of just the long-term way that our farm bill has gone, basically we are at this point giving subsidies to the producers that are basically producing the foods that we're now realizing may not be the healthiest to produce. So all of the corn and soy that's basically the foundation of a lot of the processed food products and the more industrial ways of producing food. So there is some support for alternative pieces of food. However, creating basically an alternative food system. However, mm-hmm. that ends up being a much smaller part of where the funding goes. And part of that is who has the power to kind of advocate to the government. And I think that that's what we need to shift, because if we can make those the more prominent piece of it, we can create supports that will actually, basically make sure that the farmers are still getting paid what they need to produce these good quality foods, and that they are less expensive. I think that way then we can shift the government programs to basically move towards those, because those will be the more dominant part of the food system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like even when I hear, McDonald's is going to start shifting over and only, and the meat that they're going to provide or the chicken they're going to provide is going to be antibiotic-free and hormone-free, part of me doesn't believe them, but then part of me is like, well, great, because then that will put the pressure on the supply, like you were saying, and so it will force many of the producers to transition over to create, raise chickens that are antibiotic-free and hormone-free to meet that supply, because right now we wouldn't have enough meat or chicken to supply McDonald's that is antibiotic free and hormone free. So,
You're right. And people from the farming industry are actually contacting me to talk about that and saying, wait a second, we're going to need to shift, because what food companies are asking us for, which is being driven by consumer demand for this, is really changing. And I think that, it's going to take a long time to change, because it took a long time to get the food system that we have now. Yet, mm-hmm. I think we're really at the dawning of seeing a lot of big change in front of us. And I think that the more that consumers can keep saying, these are the kinds of products we want, and pushing back on that to food companies, which will push it back on the government and push it back on the food producers to make sure that we have the food supply that we all deserve, want, mm-hmm. and should have.
Right. But, it just makes me nuts, the WIC program, because you don't have that flexibility, and that's predominantly the foods that are being subsidized in that program, right? The milk, the eggs, the cheese. What else is in there?
Yeah, it's cereals and grain foods, and there's a bunch. On the other hand, it really is trying to get. I mean, I agree with you. On the other hand, it really is a program that is trying to get the moms and the children basically the nutrition that they need. And is more kind of whole foods oriented, or whole basic foods from plants and animals than a lot of our food supply. And so, I agree with you. It's a step, and we can change the food supply even more to get it more in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. Now, so do you think that major food corporations are really are ready to make this kind of change? You said some of them are actually contacting you. What are they saying? What kind of changes are they looking to make?
Well, I think, it's been in the news that there's always new announcements, like General Mills taking out artificial flavors and Campbell's going back to more whole food ingredients. I think that they're scared for their future as businesses, and I think that they're acting like scared companies and trying to make these changes. I think that these reformulations take time. I think that why they are still so involved in trying to push for food policy, and probably most of your listeners follow the whole debate over the dietary guidelines for Americans and should sustainability be in the dietary guidelines, which food companies pushed back on because that would make people look really carefully about how their food is produced, and so that's scary to them. I think what they're trying to do is try to slow down the pace that the change is going to be demanded, because they realize that it's going to take them time to make change. On the other hand, I think for consumers, how we can push back is we're pushing for the change to happen quickly, and we're pushing for it to happen. And that's why there's some new companies that are, you know, like some of the new healthier fast food, fast casual kind of food stores that are actually growing by leaps and bounds, because they're talking about where they're sourcing their food from. They're talking about whether their foods have antibiotics in them or hormones in them. And that's what consumers want. They want companies that are not just talking about the nutrients that are in their food, but companies that are talking about how they're getting their ingredients, how they're preparing them, what farms they're supporting, even are the farmers that are growing the food or all the people along the food chain getting paid fair wages. That's what people are really caring about today.
Mm-hmm. And how much of your work or have you been addressing the fair labor wages in New York City? And where do you stand on that?
Well, I think that we should be addressing fair labor wages, and I support it completely. With all the other work that we're doing, I haven't been working that directly on it, and
right.
I'm really supportive of it.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about the Child Nutrition Reauthorization Act? I know lots of people don't really know what that is, and I know last time it was voted on, I think they took money from SNAP to support the Child Reauthorization Act, and then they promised to give it back, and then they didn't. What I know Tisch Food Center is working along with City Harvest to look into that a little bit. Can you share with us a little bit about that?
Sure. And just to back up, so Child Nutrition Act is basically the government policy that funds all of the child nutrition related programs that we have in this country. One of the biggest is school lunch. It's also where the Women, Infants, and Children's program that we were just speaking about is, as well as a lot of other programs. And so every 5 years, the federal government, or about every 5 years, the federal government reauthorizes this and basically re-looks at the policy. So a lot of the funding change, stays the same. Of course, there's always going to be funding for school meals and all of that kind of stuff, but then there are some things that change. And so what we realized in New York City for the last time around, which led to the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act, was the name of the child nutrition reauthorization that President Obama signed in December of 2010, is we realized in New York City that the advocates that were really pushing for moving these programs to making sure that children got good quality food, access to good quality food through these programs, realized that sometimes the advocacy groups were sending different messages to politicians, even though they really wanted very similar things. But the way it was coming across was a little bit different, and so City Harvest brought together a large group of organizations in New York City to have one policy platform, and it really helped to unify the New York City voice about what we were advocating for what became the 2010 bill. It was really broke everybody's heart, basically, when money was taken away from SNAP to basically give to child nutrition, because it's the same families. And so it was, well, we're going to take away the resources that they have to buy their groceries by basically giving 6 more cents a meal to schools to be able to produce these foods. Now, that 6 cents a meal did help schools. A lot of people certainly think that it should be a lot more, because then schools could actually get a wider range of healthier foods, because we know that healthier foods can be more expensive. The other thing that the 2010 bill did is it really upped the nutrition standards to basically have more fruits, vegetables, and whole grains in the meals. And so now it's the child nutrition, we're basically the standards, the good news is the standards should stay the same. There was pushback on them for a while, but now
big
I think
pushback.
Really... And there was a big pushback, but
yeah.
You know what? The good news is now schools have been doing it long enough that basically 95% of schools are meeting the standards. And so, you know, it's, there's no reason to push back on them anymore because schools are meeting them. All the research has shown that it's not decreasing how much kids are eating overall, and it is actually leading to more fruits and vegetables on the plate and hopefully increasing consumption of those.
And childhood obesity really did go down for the first time in many years.
Exactly. Yes,
right.
Yes. What we really pushed for in the bill, and we're hoping will really stay in as the bill moves its way through Congress, is really doing a study to understand how nutrition education is funded in the government. Because as I said many times before, is we really believe that when good quality nutrition education that gets kids excited about eating well is combined with this access to good food, it makes those federal dollars that are going into doing this go much further, because then the kids mm-hmm. are eating the food and it really is changing their eating habits, and hopefully that's going back home to the families
exactly,
for a lifetime,
yeah.
which will
uh-huh.
help everything.
Right, right. And, it, you know, I think it really is making a difference. I know, you know, in the 30 years that I've been working on this, you know, I have certainly seen changes. I mean, I used to be, you know, a one-man or one-woman show out here. And, you know, there's definitely momentum going, and it's moving in the right direction. And, wow, the work you're doing is great, Pam. I'm so glad.
Thank you. We keep busy, that's for sure.
I know, I know. Well, I certainly will see you at the Just Food Conference. I plan on attending. And I want to thank you so much for joining us. It's been really wonderful. Is there anything else you're doing or anything you'd like to share, the Tisch Center website, et cetera, before we run out of time?
Well, I mean, you can always go onto our website and sign up for our newsletter to keep in touch with all the things we're doing related to curriculum development, resources, policy, research. We do a lot of research, and so I think anybody who liked what they heard and want to find out more, just Google Tisch Food Center, and you'll be able to find us. And
wonderful.
I hope to see many of you listening at the Just Food Conference and meet you all there.
Wonderful. Thank you, Pam. It's been wonderful. Everyone who's been listening, thank you so much for joining us. Have a great rest of the week. Have a wonderful Valentine's Day, and I'll see you all again next week. Bye for now.